everybody. Welcome to episode 175 of the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. This is your host, Jason Klom. This episode is part two of our Richard Levinson episode. Last week was part one, of course. We're talking about National Lampoon's Gold Turkey. We have some new clips in this episode, as per usual. We've also got a number of really great episodes coming up. Just recorded a bunch of really great stuff. We've got, I don't know, 10 or 12 episodes in the can. They'll be slowly rolling out with some people you may have heard of, people maybe you haven't. We'll be talking about a variety of things, including a Record Store Day exclusive. It's to the UK, which, by the way, if you're out there in the UK and you want to pick me up the Alan Partridge album and, you know, do your good host a favor, I would not turn it down. So enjoy this episode. I'm just going to do the plug up top. Go to lookingforwardmovie.com. It's a sequel to my movie from 2012. It's a series of video blogs. After the first month, we have somehow exceeded an hour. So at the end of these 9 months, we're going to have about, you know, 9 hours of footage or more. Probably closer to 12 is my guess. We're going to cut a movie out of that. But really, the movie in its purest form is going to exist as a series of video blogs. So enjoy that. 14 different characters. It's my fake presidential campaign. You can also go to jk2016.com. That's my presidential campaign blog, but really everything is at lookingforwardmovie.com. So enjoy this episode. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 1975. The album is Gold Turkey. The artist is the National Lampoon. It is a greatest hits album. My guest is Richard Levinson.
Well, one thing I did stop doing is I stopped trying to be topical with comedy. You probably know them. You may have listened to their albums, Ron Stevens and Joy Grydnick.
That a guest brought, a fan brought them up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in relation to your name somehow. So I think that name has come up once.
Yeah. They had a... they were radio people in St. Louis. No, actually, they're actually back there after they're all around the country. But they lived here for quite some time. And they had a radio, syndicated radio service called All Star Radio, where they would produce comedy every single morning that got sent out all to radio stations all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea why I just brought up Ron Stevens and Joy Grydnick. What were we just talking about a second ago?
Good question, because this is one of those moments, like I said.
There was a real point. We were talking about
discipline and getting it done.
Here it is.
Yeah.
I stopped writing topically
mm-hmm.
because I will take subject matters like war. That's
sure.
fine.
Sure.
Or things that may have some shelf life. But I was working with them, and this is long before you two were born. In 1987, Gary Hart was running for...
okay. A little bit after.
I guess 87. Gary Hart was running for president. I guess it was 87. Maybe it was even 86 when this happened. Maybe it was 87. And he was running for president. He was doing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got caught.
Oh, yeah.
With having an affair
mm-hmm.
with this Donna Rice woman
mm-hmm.
on some boat. And he was also kind of belligerent about it. He actually dared people to follow him. So he got caught. And he was a senator from Colorado. So I don't know why I did this, but I ran out to the coffee. I used to write at Twain's Coffee Shop here in the Valley. And I ran out, got my piece of paper, and sat down. And an hour and a half later, I'd written a song called The Man from Colorado's Big Boner.
Jesus.
And of course,
Christ.
Ron loved it. You know, Ron, and so we went up and I went to his house. Okay, so I wrote it on Thursday. I went to Ron's house on Friday, and just with his little radio studio with one little keyboard, we recorded the song.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote in from Colorado out to be the president. It was one of these sort of talking 1960s cowboy songs.
Okay.
So he was the man from Colorado, and it was really, really funny.
Mm-hmm.
So on Friday, we recorded it. I drove it over to Dr. Demento's house,
mm-hmm.
who I knew at the time. And I drove it over, and I said, Barry, I got a song for you. It's about Gary Hart. He goes, oh, really? That's wonderful. So I gave it to him. He put it, after listening to it, he put it on the air, but he gave it a disclaimer. He goes, like, some of my listeners might not know that the term boner
right.
was always used in its original form, was meant a mistake. It meant an error. It meant a stupid mistake that you made. And okay, yes. So he with that disclaimer, then he went ahead and played the song. the next night, Sunday night, Ron and Joey and I were doing this little show that used to be a club here in West Hollywood called Carlos and Charlie's. And we were doing a fake radio show at a nightclub upstairs at Carlos and Charlie's.
Mm-hmm.
Comics used to work out there. Joan Rivers did shows there and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I was like the musician off to the side, and he was doing the bits and his wife, Joy. And then they had me do the song Man from Colorado's mm-hmm. Big Boner. Okay, so now it's Sunday night. So Thursday, the thing happens, I write the song. Friday, we record the song. Saturday, Dr. Demento plays it. Sunday, and this is a long song, a very hard work, and okay. very intricate, right? Sunday, we play the song, and a woman comes up to me and goes, "Did you write that song?" I said, "Yeah, I did." She goes, "Oh, I was driving back from Palm Springs last night, and I heard that song. I almost drove off the road. I was listening to Dr. Demento. It was the funniest thing I ever heard in my life. Thank you for writing that song." I said, "Oh, well, thank you for telling me that." And then Monday came along, and my world was empty.
Yeah.
It was like, okay, so what do I get out of this now? I made at least one person very, very happy.
Sure, yeah.
And probably, I'm going to guess, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people very happy mm-hmm. across the country. And some of them may even sort of remember my name, because you just, even right now, you just said somebody
mm-hmm.
remembered.
It was Demento's archivist.
Archivist,
yep,
exactly.
There you go.
So he's the guy who would remember mm-hmm. that. Yeah, so, but then I thought, but this song is literally dead now. It's gone.
Right.
I mean, a week from now, no one's going to remember who Gary Hart was.
Right.
Or
right.
why the jokes in the song make any sense at all.
Sure.
So I just began thinking, I love writing topically. I love being in the midst of what's going on, especially politically at
yeah.
the moment. But I will never do it again. It's too much work with no return.
Right.
So you try to find a broader theme. I wrote a song in the early 1990s, literally 91, I think, called The Winter of the Mideast War.
Uh-huh.
And every time peace would break out every couple of years, I would just put the song away because I said, well, okay, peace, you know. And then, you know, things would get worse and I'd bring the song back out. Matty loved the song. He always wanted to use it in a show.
Mm-hmm.
The people who ran the Lampoon more recently, they just wanted to have stupid sex songs and stuff. They didn't want to use that song. But that song, even though it was topical when I wrote it at the time, because it was about the second Intifada, I think, Intifada, sorry. And I just thought, this is never going to get resolved, and they're going to be fighting with each other forever. So I wrote this kind of sort of sad and funny song about being like the last man standing
mm-hmm.
In whatever the iteration of the Mideast War was at the time. And I'll send that one to you. It has lasted because that situation has lasted, and does nothing but get worse.
Right.
So you know, I don't mind. I did write a few when the Iraq War broke out, because I had a few places to send things. I did write a couple of songs. One was called Iraqi Lullaby, and the other one was called We've Got Bulgaria.
Uh-huh.
When we were trying to sign up people for our Coalition of the Willing.
Ah, yes, yeah.
And you know, we really couldn't get anybody, but then there was the big news was that we've gotten Bulgaria. I think the last line was, you know, if once we get Spain and Italy, then we'll have the big three. we've got Bulgaria. And I still like these songs. I mean, to me, they still make me laugh, because I know I felt like when I was writing them, and I know the situation. But again, that war is 13 years ago now. Nobody, it means nothing to anybody.
Right.
Tom Lehrer got away with it a little bit because he did the songs on TV once a week.
Yeah.
And they are sort of timeless. Pollution, Vatican Rag, even if you don't know the story behind Vatican Rag.
Sure.
It's still funny.
Mm-hmm.
So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be back when the war is over an hour and a half from now. You know, you don't really have to be in the middle of the Cold War to necessarily get that.
Sure.
But yeah, when you're writing just really, really topically about what happened that week, And then you start turning into like Mark Russell, and you know,
right.
Who the hell wants to turn into Mark Russell? Or even worse, the Capitol.
The Capitol Steps. Yep.
Does everybody who comes in here hate the Capitol Steps as much as I do?
It's the first time they've come up, but I'm glad that you're on this in the same camp as I am. That's fine with me.
I did a 3-line parody once of Mark Russell. Do you think they will pass the bill up on Capitol Hill? And then crickets are like.
That's actually one of my favorite TV shows of all time is News Radio. One of my favorite episodes.
When
of that.
They open the elevator door, and
yes.
he's like, Johnny comes marking home again. He's gay. He's gay.
Fucking great! Holy shit! The whole time. Oh, and they had the. I think the title of that episode is Public Domain because the only things they can parody were public domain. Holy shit!
Yeah, yep. And yep, it's weird. It also, and that's I think maybe that getting way back to what we're talking about with this album.
Mm-hmm.
There is, even to this day, there is a received wisdom among the elites, the power class, the people who sort of run things, about who's funny, what's okay to be funny. And sometimes you just want to throw a bomb at it. And I think that's why going back to the thing about the actress it's not too much attacking her, it's attacking this system, which is taking this tragedy and putting her on TV in order to sell coffee.
Sure.
And I, you know, so you like to get the machine guns out once in a while,
mm-hmm.
you know. Well, Donahue said that comedy was no longer I forget what he said, but he said, comedy is now a baby seal hunt.
Uh-huh.
You know, and you know, so going, yes, and there's going to be some collateral damage. Go out and start shooting around, and you're going to take some people down who maybe you shouldn't be. But even now you have that. Even now it's like there's like the okay approved comedy.
Yeah.
And then it's really difficult to get. I mean, I as much as I love Stephen Colbert, and he was, I think what really gratified me about Stephen Colbert was not so much he was so great what he did, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But how so many people seem to get it.
Will the defendant please rise?
Mr. Capone, I have decided to show leniency and not sentence you to death. However, I hereby sentence you to a dose of syphilis.
People really did, they understood the joke. They got
right.
it. And that was heartening to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it shocked me, actually, that enough people got it. It was pleasant. I did not get to see his new show. Obviously, it's not going to be nearly as political at all.
I'm less.
Maybe a little. I don't know.
I got so tired of Letterman after a while first 4 or 5 years I thought he was brilliant, and then it just his personality is kind of ugly, really. You know, it's very funny and talented,
yeah.
Like, but just being snarky didn't seem to be quite enough.
Right.
And yeah. when someone, well, you must have seen this. Yeah, of course you probably did. In American Splendor,
uh-huh.
you know, where he comes on the show.
Oh, yeah.
And he comes on and starts lambasting General Electric and NBC mm-hmm. for anti-union behaviors. And Letterman gets really pissed off at him.
Yeah.
I think it was nice of Letterman to allow that footage to be used in the movie, though.
Right.
Which he was a match for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had always wondered, and I still wonder, how much of David Letterman's snark, and even, frankly, how much of his old man persona was him, and how much of it was just, here's a character I'm going to give you, and fuck you, you don't get to know if this is me or not. There's a lot of that, it always
seemed
to me.
You know, it's a lot of pressure doing those shows. I remember a friend of mine went to a taping of the show,
mm-hmm.
and he said, you know, all these asides to Paul and everything,
mm-hmm.
he was sitting in the third or fourth row, and so he could see the shot list on the camera.
Uh-huh.
Every single shot was pre-choreographed.
There
was nothing that you know, Dave says blah blah blah, go to Paul, boom.
Oh my God.
And of course Johnny Carson controlled his show that way too.
Yeah.
And the effort that goes into creating the feeling of spontaneity.
Yeah.
If you're really good at it, that's something that and you know, George Carlin said that he would go around for a year doing his creating his act
mm-hmm.
in small clubs around the country before in preparation for an HBO special.
Yeah.
And at, he told me this, because I interviewed him once. He told me at the end of every show, he said, well, I've worked for 2.5 hours, right? But most people work for 8 hours, so I figure I got 5 more hours of work today.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He sat down and wrote a review of every single show that he ever did after
Jesus
the show. He sat down
Christ.
With a notebook, and he wrote down what jokes worked, what jokes didn't work, how to change things. I mean, he took it as a business. So that,
yeah.
that notion of that tip of the iceberg that you see when a really professional performer comes out, you're not seeing something that just occurred to him at that moment. You're
yeah.
seeing just and Carlin was very proud of the fact that he could go on Johnny Carson, and at that point he was like the number one guest host for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
He could go on Carson and do a 10-minute monologue totally clean.
Yeah.
Be absolutely and he told me, he's like, I'm very proud of the fact that I do my act, I go to colleges, I do what I do. I'm a different person. I know what's appropriate on the stage for
mm-hmm.
this thing, and I can go out there and I can be just as funny. I'll get a laugh every 30 seconds for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And being entirely clean. And he was. He came out and did a brilliant monologue.
So good.
Well, I was interviewing for some magazine.
That's awesome.
Actually, the day my daughter was born.
Crazy.
Yes. I interviewed him, like, literally. I've been in the hospital all night long with my wife, and I had to run over and interview George Carlin.
Holy shit.
It was, it was something. But,
wow.
But it was, you know, it was in a pretty bracing time, and then I went and saw him guest host at Tonight Show. I went back to his dressing room afterwards and talked to him.
Jesus. What year is this?
Oh, my daughter's 33, so this is 1982.
1982.
He was just coming out of one of his his first rehab and heart surgery.
Oh,
he was
yeah, huh?
Like, sort of like George's back
kind
of thing back then.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I you know, and there's a playfulness, when we're talking about this record, there's always a playfulness, but the real satisfaction, I think, for these people of doing this is just working to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
Getting it right. And what the idea is funny. You're sitting around at a bar and you have these really funny ideas, write them down, and that's when you get to laugh.
Yeah.
But now when you go into the studio and you're going to make this work, you're not going to laugh anymore. Now you're going to try to make it so it's actually just perfect.
See, that's the thing. That's something that I've always assumed about SNL is the opposite. It's like, this really worked in the room. It's going to work on TV. They're all in the room with us. They're all as high as we are. They're all. It's the camaraderie. I mean, we've all had
right.
those nights.
Yes.
We've all had, like, my best friend and I do a podcast where we're fully aware that 90% of that is just for us.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that. We couldn't turn that into anything workable, but it's fucking hilarious in the moment.
Yeah.
That's sometimes why podcasts work, because you are there in the moment. Great. But that's not, I'm under no illusion that that would ever work as a sketch show.
Yeah.
You know, I could tweak it for, give me, like, 3 weeks to tweak that conversation into a sketch. I can
yeah,
do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But SNL seems to be, and I'm not, I don't want to be a person who just shits on SNL. SNL's fine. It's a great proving ground for stuff. But in general,
it goes up and down. I don't watch it very much anymore. It had its early seasons, which again now seem a little bit. First of all, they were lit very dark, and the whole thing just
yeah.
had a whole different attitude.
It's very
about
true.
It for, and then. O'Donohue left, and then it got a little more show busy, and then they had that second wind when Harry Shearer and Christopher Guest were on it,
yeah.
and Billy Crystal,
mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, they were just professionally funny. I don't think
yeah.
they had a real sense of mission, but they were just very, very funny people.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, the commitment to building characters, which really, I think, comes out of the way the Groundlings do things,
mm-hmm.
which is to create branded characters for yourself. You know,
yeah.
work on it, create a character, stick with the character, make, you know, put the character in situations. And that's why you see, like, the Monkey Man. Well, the Monkey Man's on a ship. The Monkey Man's in a jail.
Yeah, yeah.
The Monkey Man's at the ice cream store. I mean, it's just, it's the same bit, it's just now it's in a different place.
Yeah.
So I lost interest, but I'll tell you what really bugs me about that show now. It's not so much that I mean, maybe I'm just getting old, and it's not for me. I mean, people like it or they don't like it. Some people said this year is really good. You couldn't prove it by me. But I've watched a lot of sketches there where they're just reading them straight off the cue cards.
Yeah.
There's, like, no rehearsal at all. And I guess this comes from last-minute picking of sketches and last-minute changes and
yeah.
last-minute insertions. So they're barely acting at all. They're just reading directly off. And at least back in the old days...
Mm-hmm.
They were rehearsed. You never saw someone glancing at a...
No,
the guest host, if he wasn't a real actor.
Sure. But
the cast, they John Belushi, he considered himself an actor.
Yeah.
Bill Murray is an actor. We're gonna know our lines.
Yeah. Gilda Radner couldn't spaz out like that and have a cue card. You know what I mean? Like, she had to have shit in her head, you know?
Exactly.
She had to be jumping around the room. You have to have that stuff ready to go.
Yeah, and of course, her stage show was... Well, Michael O'Donoghue wrote most of her stage show.
Really?
The Broadway show. Let's Talk Dirty to the Animals. and things like that. Yeah, I'm not sure how I would have survived with those people. They were really, you know, at a level of sharkdom that is sort of not seen now. You know, now all those people drift. The people who were that good and that sharp drifted into TV because that's where money was, and so there was no way to put together. Once in a while, you see some stuff on Funny or Die, which is kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of there, but it just doesn't have the same. To me, it doesn't have the same spirit.
Sure,
it doesn't have the same underlying sense of disquiet or anger.
Right. No, and that's that's 100% missing. And that's for me. I mean, that's the value of listening to something like this, even if it does make you uncomfortable. I mean, obviously, my first laugh at the Well-Intentioned Blues. Not to necessarily go back to. I love ironic racism, but to go back to that, it's just like it makes me instantly uncomfortable, and that's where the laugh comes from. And I assume. Also, I assume because Christopher Guest is doing that dumbass James Taylor voice that he also used for Mighty Wind, that I'm like, okay, there's obviously something happening here. Like, God,
right.
That voice is just, that is a fucking, that goat, oh my God. So, but I think there's something to it to listen to these albums, and I'm kind of looking forward to listening to the more upsetting ones, just because, you know, it makes you think. If for lack of a better,
you know,
phrase.
A Radio Dinner. There's a couple of very long pieces on there that aren't really all that funny.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some parodies of, some funny parodies of things. There's a game show called Catch It and You Keep It, where basically they throw Kenmore washing machines off
Jesus
a building,
Christ.
And if you catch it, you keep it.
Uh-huh.
But there's also a bit, the tragedy team of Raza and Kar, who were Bangladeshi comedians.
Uh-huh.
And they're doing they're doing tragedy jokes. You know?
Yeah.
And it's all about starvation and death and suffering.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And, but there's also, are you a Beatles fan?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, then. There is the classic John Lennon parody is on that album.
Really?
They took John Lennon's words. He had done an interview in Playboy magazine after the Beatles broke up.
Mm-hmm.
He was very angry. He said all sorts of stuff that he probably regretted later on. And this guy named Christopher Cerf, who was Bennett Cerf's son,
uh-huh.
a very literary guy, took those words, rearranged them a little bit, and put this kind of Beatley piano part behind it. And then Tony Hendra, who was actually English, had never performed as trying to be John Lennon before, he went in and just started screaming these words, and they named the song "Genius Is Pain," and they added a few little Beatle-like lines of that sounded like lines that John Lennon would write, but mainly it's just his own words being shouted back at him.
Amazing.
And it is just nasty. It's
yeah.
so funny. And if you do like the Beatles, if you were a Beatles fan, you have to listen to "Genius Is Pain."
Oh yeah.
From the. Radio Dinner album.
There are winners and losers in the game.
Oh, I didn't know that.
God damn it, I asked you to listen, and by God, you're going to listen to what I got to say.
Okay.
Now, that's right. Winners and losers. But there's some guys who don't even get to finish the game. Maybe the coach takes them out, or maybe they're injured. They don't even stay in the game long enough to feel like they won or lost.
Now, come on, what you talking about, coach?
I'm talking about this, Stretch. There's a big coach somewhere in the universe. And he's about to cut the team.
Huh? What? What do you mean? What are you talking about? Huh.
I mean, Stefanski, you got leukoplakia.
What? What's that?
It's a rare form of lung cancer.
Leukoplakia.
The doc says you might not last this season.
Oh, breaks. Sorry, really. Oh,
really, really.
I suppose that one of us ought to say something, coach, and as defensive captain.
Wait, that's not all. Luciano has Huntington's chorea.
What?
They're taking you to the hospital at halftime, Lucky.
Oh, no.
And to be fair, I'm a Beatles fan, not a John Lennon fan necessarily. So that's fine with me. you know, I mean, I don't hate the man or anything, but he was kind of a dick. Did you hear recently about? Sorry, this is just a side note, real quick. I talked about this on my other podcast. The most valuable record of all time now is Mark David Chapman's signed Double Fantasy. Oh. It sold for over $1 million because it originally sold for $100,000, and then has since been sold and sold and sold.
It doesn't surprise me.
No, but it's just so weird and morbid.
I mean, there's some baby boomer who's got $1 million to spend, and that he thinks it's. I would think you'd take it and burn it.
Right.
You know.
Right. It's so morbid.
Yeah, it's not something I would want to have around.
No. No, I mean, if yeah.
Like, are there, like, blood stains on it or something?
No, luckily, he put it aside. Oddly enough, put it aside before he did his thing. It's really creepy and weird. And it was picked up by a doorman who, like, held on to it for years and then sold it because he needed the money, and now it's, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know exactly where I was when the night that John Lennon got killed. I was actually, there's a building in Hollywood called 6255 Sunset.
Yeah.
Right between Argyle and Vine on Sunset, that used to be almost like a West Coast Brill building.
Okay.
Motown Records was in there, a company called BMI, which is one of the performing rights organizations, was there. The company that at the time owned the Beatles catalog, ATV, was there. Garrett Music was there, Snuff Garrett, where I was working, and also the Welk Music Group, who Lawrence Welk owned, one of the biggest publishers at the time, country publishing, all sorts of stuff. And I was there writing a song with somebody.
Uh-huh.
And we were up there writing a song or something, and I went out and had some dinner afterwards and heard on the radio that John Lennon had been shot.
Yeah.
So this is weird. I mean, it's very rare that I know exactly where I am at some point, but that's where I was.
I was thinking about this the other day. Like, anymore, it's like, I know where I was. Yeah, on the internet. I was looking on the internet. There's no experience of these tragedies, so they just wash by.
Well, that's true, and I think there's one of the problems with living life on a screen is everything gets equalized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pictures of actual tragedy. I have a lot of friends who are very much into horror films, and produce them. I mean, one of my friends was the production designer on the Blair Witch Project, and has done a lot of horror web series and films.
Oh, okay.
And he's had his own films. He's a film editor as well. Very talented guy, very funny, a good director and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But he's really into horror. He really loves horror. And I just find that reality right now is so horrible. It's very difficult for me to enjoy fake horror.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because it can look kind of the same.
Oh, sure.
As the next thing you see on the internet, where a bunch of drowned people have just washed up on shore in Greece or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I tend to stay away from. I don't mind horror in a satiric way.
Sure.
If you are using it.
Yeah, that was gonna be my next question. Yeah.
But simply enjoying someone, you know, watching a movie and being surprised that, you know, I happened to was watching, because for some reason I get Showtime for free right now. I don't know why. And I had never seen the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh,
before.
Shit.
Not the original one, but the remake.
Yeah.
And I was, I said, okay, I'll make myself watch a little of this. And, you know, within the first couple of minutes where the guy and the girl go in the house and he gets killed first and then she follows him in and then she gets picked up and hung on the meat hook. And that was it for me.
Yeah.
You know, he pulled out the chainsaw and I said, nope, that's it.
Yep.
I'm not going to. That this is blood porn that I'm not going to participate in.
It's a weird challenge to people who love that stuff. They want to be challenged and scared, whereas this is closer to that for us, where like being challenged, but at the same time, I'd rather be laughed while I'm challenged.
Sure,
I'd rather laugh at pain, not because I think pain is funny, because it's so fucking miserable that I'd rather laugh. So yeah, it is a very interesting dichotomy.
Well, there's a way. I mean, Mad Magazine. We were talking about magazines and Lampoon. Even Mad Magazine, that was not always really, really vicious, but they made, I remember I was a kid, I must have been no more than 11 or 12 years old, and they were doing a parody, one of their written parodies, or their drawn parodies, of Hogan's Heroes.
Okay.
And, you know, it was like, they did these little parody Hogan's Heroes, I don't know what they called it. And at the end, I remember this to this day, at the end, they were making fun of the fact that a show like this even existed, about a prison camp in Germany. They said, well, this show is so good, our next show is going to be even better. And you turn the page, and it's Mort Drucker, or one of the great artists, Jack Davis from the Lamp, from Mad Magazine, having drawn one of those pictures of inside one of the death camps, you know, where they had like the the wooden bunk beds of, mm-hmm. you know, and they're all the people are all crammed inside there,
yeah.
kind of looking out. And he had done a cartoony drawing of that.
Holy
about
shit.
About how the next show is going to be like the wacky misadventures of a bunch of people at Auschwitz or some death camp.
Holy
and,
shit.
And it was, I mean, it was, yeah. So, yeah, there's so, I mean, there's real horror, there's real stuff, and I don't mind using that even as Mel Brooks did. I don't mind Hitler jokes.
Sure.
I mean, Hitler's a pretty go-to guy for mm-hmm. for comedy if you need someone, mm-hmm. you go to Hitler. But I blood and gore, it just seems like, why would you want to escape into that?
I
don't get it.
I mean, yeah, I'd rather it sort of be trying to teach me something like this is, you know, even if it's not explicitly doing it, it's a challenge that I'm fine to accept, you know.
Go ahead.
No. We are actually already answered that question. I was just going to ask you. So, even with anything that's challenging on this album, and there's probably plenty of stuff that is, or stuff that's taken out of context, like even I misunderstood at least one track. Mm-hmm. What's a good reason for people to listen to this album first to get a dose of Lampoon?
Well, I think even though some of these names now are beginning to age for people, even Bill Murray. I mean, people love Bill Murray, but he's getting on. He's got to be 70 or
yeah,
more right
yeah.
now. Or in his late 60s, early 70s, whatever. I think that as I've had these conversations with a lot of people that I work with in theater, even though they seem to have ingested it, they get it. They're funny. They don't. They're just as funny as these folks were, but they don't really know where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
They just know that this is what they grew up with. There was a time when on stage before Lenny Bruce, and then obviously Richard Pryor, and then probably to some extent maybe Fireside Theater too. Not so much really, but there were things that you really couldn't do.
Yeah.
And these really were walls being smashed. So if you think of SNL as being where the wall was smashed, no, the wall came down so there could be Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
But these are the people that brought the wall down ahead of time.
Yeah.
And if you consider that, you know, two of the three writers of Animal House are in this picture as well, Doug Kenny and Harold Ramis, that you get the sense. So I think what I would tell people now is, first of all, it's just funny. I mean,
sure.
It's a funny record. You will enjoy the
Absolutely.
Record.
Absolutely.
But you'll also get a sense of the we don't live in an audio world really anymore. We live in this visual world.
Mm-hmm.
And this was where you sat down in your dorm room or your living room, or maybe later on if you had an 8-track in your car, and you just sat and you just closed your eyes and you just listened.
Mm-hmm.
And because they did such a good job of creating the audio equivalent of real radio and real radio documentaries and commercials and songs, that you know, it brings you into that space and it allows you to experience something funny that there really isn't that much of. I don't know anybody who's doing produced radio comedy now.
There's really not. There are a couple podcasts that do it really well.
Yeah.
Super Ego is the one I always turn people to if you want something that's
Super
goofy.
Ego? Okay.
Yeah, fucking hilarious. They just released, this is their first piece of vinyl-ish, they released this flexi disc.
Okay.
Brilliant stuff, really well produced. It's all from improv, actually, but it's funny. It's like they get compared to Firesign all the time, and they're like, we didn't listen to Firesign. They've only recently had to turn to them to be like, well.
Well, that's one of the. See, I think sometimes in the same way that alcoholism finds its way down through generations, even if your own parents weren't alcoholics,
mm-hmm.
somehow the virus or the genetic code
mm-hmm.
finds its way down through to you, even if you don't know where it came from.
100%.
It might be difficult for them to have invented what they do now.
Sure.
If there hadn't been Firesign Theater 45 years ago.
Oh, easily.
Even if they've never even heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they didn't know what it was. That's kind of the thing that I tend to be a little, I maybe go on too long about this with some of my friends, but I do want them to know why they're able to do some of the stuff that they're able to do.
Yeah.
And these people were not just doing, you know, they were not just another good rock band in a genre. They were inventing the genre.
Yeah.
They literally were inventing what what they they were building the tub in which they were then going to pour the wine. I'm not very good with analogies, as you may have noticed.
I like it.
But they also knew that they were parodists, and they were looking at things that already existed and doing really, really precise parodies. And I think because back then the world first was visual, magazines, and Henry Beard once said, you know, we parodied everything that had print from the New Yorker down to matchbooks.
Yeah.
I mean, and they did. If it was printed, they goofed on it.
Yeah.
And the world was also audio. It was about FM radio. It was about record albums and stuff and listening to the radio. So now, Funny or Die or wherever you see humor being done and being done well, it usually comes out of some visual. I suppose people are doing goofs of video games. I don't play video games, so
right.
I don't really know.
There are funny video games, but it's such a giant...
Are they funny video games in that they're making fun of video games, or? Well, I do think that the world of the various nerd worlds do get. A lot of my friends are really into video. Younger friends are really into video games, and they're into comic books, and they're into pop culture to an extent that I never was. I mean, they know more stuff going back from the 30s through the 2000s than I can possibly. It's amazing what they know.
Yeah.
And I think it's because they got along well with their parents, first of all, the millennials did. So they listened to a lot of, you know, classic rock on the radio in the car. But they also saw movies, and they grew up, if they're in theater, they grew up doing musicals, and they love classic musicals. So they really have a real sense of just a whole sweep of the stuff. But that allows them to parody those things with a little bit of authority.
Well, I may do that. He says, I just don't feel good. I said, Lou, you don't look good. He was pale, you know. He didn't look very, very bad. So all of a sudden, another knock came at the door. He was a young man again. He says, 1 minute, Mr. Jolson. All right. I said, I'll be right there, son. I finished putting on the wig, the minstrel wig and my tie. And in the next moment, Lou Dockstader dropped dead in my arms. He just fell down. I said, Lou, I slapped his face. I tried to give him some water. I pulled the tie away from his throat. He had turned blue. He died in my arm. And the young man knocked on my door. He says, 20 seconds, Mr. Jolson. Well, there was Lou Dockstader lying in my arm. What could I do? The curtain was coming up. The overture was being played. Jolson was wanted out there. He was out there. As far as the crowd was concerned, it didn't matter whether Lou Dockstader had just died or not. So I laid Lou Dockstader down on the floor.
We were doing a, last year, in fact, at Sacred Fools, the late night show, Serial Killers, the one I was involved with, was we made fun of a, there's little religious comic books called Chick Tracks.
Uh-huh, okay.
And they, if you've seen them, they're scurrilous. I mean, everything you do is going to send you to hell. I mean, have you ever seen these things?
They're kind of just laying about.
There's 120 of them, and each one of them just basically, if you find Jesus, you're okay, but if you don't, basically, if you're the guy who raped the 7-year-old girl, but if you become friends with Jesus, you're okay. But if the 7-year-old girl dies before she meets Jesus, sadly, she's going to hell because she didn't meet Jesus. I mean, it's these things are just, they're horror shows.
Yeah.
So this friend of mine, playwright and actress Vanessa Stewart had an idea last year and said, she grew up with these things in the South.
Uh-huh.
So she said, let's do Chick Track the musical.
That's
because
great.
I write comedy songs. I said, that's going to be really rough, but I certainly get it.
Yeah.
So she would pick one each week and she would adapt it. She called herself the curator, really, not the writer, but she did the adaptation and then sent me and the director, Paul Plunkett. And so every week I had to write a new song about the story that was being told in that particular bit.
It's crazy.
And one of the best ones was, I can't think what it was, what the name of it was, but the storyline was a girl who gets involved in a Dungeons and Dragons type show.
Uh-huh.
And she goes there, and the kids start making, I mean, she loses the game somehow. I don't know how the game works. But they kick her out because, you know, she's dead and she has to leave now.
Uh-huh.
And this is so upsetting to her that she hangs herself and kills herself. And The other girl is now very upset because her friend has hanged herself. But the woman who's running the Dungeons & Dragons type game, it's called Dark Dungeons type game, it turns out that she's a really mean, witchy person. He's like, shut up, she was no good anyway. Yeah, she deserves to die. You know, and it's like, he's like, you don't want to be like her, do you? She was a loser. He's like, and now she's dead, and that's where she belongs. And so we wrote these, I wrote this song for the girl who's dead.
Mm-hmm.
It was a three-part song. There was the woman who was the who was running the game. There was the girl who's lost her friend, and then there was the friend herself comes in as a ghost and sings about how she's dead now. But the other girl gets saved because Jesus walks in at the end, and that's her new friend. And most of the people involved in this particular little bit, and I can send you a video of this one.
Oh, awesome.
It's pretty funny. Most of the people involved in it, they're all younger than me. They're all mainly in their 30s. A lot of them are D&D players. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were able to get the scene right.
Sure.
Because they knew how it's supposed to go.
Yeah.
And they were very happy making fun, not only of the religious tract that was making fun of their game.
Sure.
But they were also kind of making fun of the fact that they knew all this stuff and they were so into it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, I mean, you really do only do a great job making fun of stuff that in some sense you're either attracted to or you know or you love in a particular way. At least the form.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons why this record works so well.
Yeah.
The subject matters are, you know, they're a little bit brutal.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people die in this record.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A lot of people die of diseases and getting punched in the stomach as a child, having a heart attack if you're a theatrical manager, you know, all sorts of things bad happen. But the form, the radio form and the performance form is something that everyone, that they're familiar with, that they get and they love, and they want to make it sound right.
Yeah.
I think the sound of that documentary, the performer giving his best performance while his manager is dying. The whole sound of that is great.
Yeah,
it has
it's
a kind
gorgeous.
Of old 16mm film sound to it. You know, and those are the details that O'Donohue was really was mad about, and that's why the whole thing was very difficult. They couldn't keep it on.
For sure, yeah. No, that's another thing too. It's so well produced. Like that, there are very few beyond National Lampoon, Monty Python, Fire Sign, and Cheech and Chong, maybe a couple others that are just like they're just so rich that you can't.
And the people that they were working with were audio people. I mean, when you went into a studio here in Los Angeles, a lot of these guys had been working in audio and splicing tape and when I was doing commercials when I first got here, this is well before the time of digital recording. So we were doing 24-track recording even for commercials. But when it would get cut down and mixed to 2-track, sometimes this engineer would literally, he was a younger guy, he would have 20 or 30 pieces of tape literally hanging around his neck.
Shit.
And he would have to look at which one it was, he'd pull it off and, you know, and then he'd splice it together because we would be splicing together, you know, and we had a great take, but let's say that we didn't like the way he said the letter S at the beginning of the word. And he was like, on Capitol Records, it didn't come out right.
Uh-huh.
So he'll find an S from somewhere else.
Oh.
But we do it all the time now with Pro Tools.
Sure, digitally,
that's no big deal. But back then, he would find the S somewhere, record it, and he would splice it on himself with a little tiny piece of tape. You know, Capitol Records. And it's like, it sounded perfect.
That hurts my brain so much.
So one of the production things about records like this is that you're working with people that were very comfortable in the audio environment and knew where to grab and how to put things together.
Mm-hmm.
Great fun to work with.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's one of those things where, I mean, I have my next comedy album is written, and it's one of those things where I'm not going to do it until I know I can spend that kind of time on it.
Yeah.
I rushed one last year. I did one in 3 months. It came out okay. I'm very happy with it, but like, you know, like, it's the next one I've got to put like some serious work behind it. It's because I love this stuff.
Do you use a lot of actors? Are these scenes or how do you?
I do. I was fortunate enough last time. Like, it's my best friend and I. Like, we did an album in like 2001, and that we released when MP3.com was a thing. And then throughout, like, we kept trying to make another album. We failed miserably at doing it. Except we would make Christmas albums for the family every year, almost every year. then we stopped doing those too. So last year we decided our next big comedy album production would be a Christmas album, and yeah, like it was us and then a few of my friends from this show called The Drinking Game. Phil Proctor did a voice on it, and James Urbaniak did a voice on it, and it's fucking fantastic. Like it was a lot of fun. But yeah, it's mostly the two of us, but acting, he's in Boise and I'm here, so acting back and forth is kind of a bitch.
Are you in touch a lot with Matthew in Minnesota?
Yeah. He's in it too, actually, very briefly. He had to literally phone it in, so I wrote him a part on a phone because I knew he didn't have a mic that he could use, so I wrote him a phone part.
I sent him a one-act musical, a script for a one-act musical. He hasn't gotten back to me, so I'm thinking maybe he doesn't like it very much. He was always very nice about the stuff that he heard of mine at Sacred Fools, but I had done a short serial for Serial Killers a long time ago. It was a parody beach movie called A Bikini Full of Trouble, and I'd written the song for Ron and Joy many, many years before that. And I decided I liked it, so I wanted to do an actual beach movie parody. And so I finally, with this other writer named Bill Robbins, after 6 or 7 years, I finally sat him down and said, we're going to finish this thing. So I finished it and wrote a new song for it and put together some old songs. And so it exists now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because we're talking about the word Negro.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene in there where one of the beach girls, the Beach Bunny girls from 1963 or 64, she's sort of, because she gets mad at her dad about something, she goes out and gets a Negro boyfriend.
Oh, no.
And then, and it takes place in Biff's Landing, California. So she goes to South Biff's Landing to get the boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And when she comes back, she's like, instead of being a beach girl, now she looks like a kind of a 1960s folk singer, kind of beatnik folk singer, Jewish girl, like. Fawn Leibowitz from Animal House.
Mm-hmm.
And so she sings a song, and she's supposed to sing it like Bob Dylan.
Uh-huh.
And it's called Hey Old Mr. White Man. it's like times they, it's kind of like the times they are changing.
Okay, okay.
But it's all about how she's going to date her Negro.
Mm-hmm.
And then her dad is actually in the audience, comes over and whispers to her. So the last verse she sings is, well, you may have won this time, but it turns out that the father... What we learn in the song is that the father has told her that if she doesn't get rid of the boyfriend, that he's taken away the keys to the car.
Uh-huh.
And she says, well, you may have won this time. I may not get to see my Negro boyfriend, but something about getting keeping the car. And when I do, I'm going to drive off in the car. And when I do, I'm going off to meet my brand new Jew.
Holy shit. Holy shit.
I did a demo of it myself. It's, uh-huh. It's pretty funny. And I want this. It has a very early... Lampoony
mm-hmm.
feel to the whole piece.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't know if it reads that way to people now.
Right.
I'm hoping that someone somewhere will want to do it.
You'll spend more time on jury duty than these men spend in jail. Prison Farm, where Nixon's men and the nation's most desirable criminals are sent away for hard middle management for as long as they like. Prison Farm, where men are forced to live like kings. Watch men endure brutal beatings.
Down 6, doubled and vulnerable. Jesus, that's 1,600 points.
Looks like bridge just isn't your game, Jeb.
Hear the screams of agony in the hot box.
Wow, this steam is hot. I think I'll take a dip in the pool.
Watch men suffer the torturous hellhole.
Well, if I'm long, I'm in the sand trap. If I'm short, I'm in the water.
Prison Farm, where there is no escape.
All right, men, we're going over the hedge.
Not in these pants, I'm not.
Warning, Prison Farm is not for the squeamish. If you can't stand the sight of striped shirts with plaid pants, stay away.
One of the songs has found its way. It's been in 7 or 8 different things. It was in Just Say Julie. It was in the Class of 86 show. It was on Dr. Demento. I keep rewriting it, reusing mm-hmm. it over and over. It's the Don't Drop the Bomb, My Boyfriend song. Use it over and over and over again.
Cause yeah.
One of these days I want someone to recognize what a piece of genius it is. But yeah, I would love... I sent this to Matthew because I know he does theater up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like someone away from me should try to do it. You know, I want to see if it'll get... If it works without my heavy fist... in the middle of it.
Is there anything that's going up now that you should promote, tell anybody about?
right now, not that I've written or anything, but right now there is a this Friday night. When will this go up, by the way?
I don't know. I have about 12 episodes banked, so that's 12 weeks worth. I'm not sure.
Okay, in that case, I probably shouldn't pitch anything. I probably shouldn't talk about anything. Just so you know, this week at Sacred Fools, there's a new adaptation of Voltaire's Candide.
Oh.
Which is going up. It's very farcical. It's being mm-hmm. done with six actors with lots of costume changes and mm-hmm. Backstage in and off, wigs, everything. It's very, very funny. I'm the only reason I'm at is I'm co-producing it, which mm-hmm. in theater basically means you run around, dump the garbage, get
yep.
the postcards
yep.
printed, and you know, there's not a lot of glamour attached to producing theater. But I love this company. I love Sacred Fools. I love doing
great.
It.
Yeah.
And I am a company member, and we have responsibilities to work on shows that are not our shows, that
yeah.
to support other people's shows. So I'm very happy to do it, and it's going to be a really good show, too.
I have a lot of friends who put on shows there who are in the company.
Oh, at Sacred Fools?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Jamie Andrews.
Oh, Jamie? Really?
Yeah. How
Lauren do you know
Napoli.
Jamie is
I don't know how I know her.
She's co-producing, she's associate producing Candide with me.
Oh, okay.
And she was the one who brought my musical in Saving Up for Saturday Night, and when she was on the artistic committee six years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
Laura Napoli is literally one of my favorite people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We're not really close friends.
Sure.
But we get along really well. She gave one of the funniest auditions I've ever seen in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot what the show was, a couple of years ago, and we asked people to come in and do a death scene.
Mm-hmm.
And she is, you know, she's very physical, and she does, you know. She came in and she did the death of the Mad Monk.
Oh, shit. Uh-huh. Rasputin.
Rasputin.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't just die, drowned, whatever. She went through everything they tried on it.
Oh, okay.
With poison
and
gunshots and stabbing, two drownings, hanging, and she just physically mimed this whole thing.
That's
until
awesome.
Finally she ended up like drowned underwater, just sort of like floating. It was the funniest audition piece I think I've ever seen.
That's awesome.
And by the way,
mm-hmm.
we talk about doing visual. You should see this sometime. The guy I told you about who was the a long time ago was the designer for the Blair Witch Project.
Mm-hmm.
He and Laura put together a pro-Obama commercial during the second election
mm-hmm.
that was based on these Republicans talking about, you know, rape. If it's a legitimate rape, it'll shut that whole thing down.
Oh, yes. I remember that video, yeah.
Did you see the video?
Yeah, I did
see
that
one.
Yeah.
Well, that's Ben. Who and they wrote that in like just that morning and shot it in one day
mm-hmm.
and he's so good with I mean he just grabbed it all and they got the language right
mm-hmm.
and they got the I just thought that was so they had a point of view and this and it reminds me very much of this they
mm-hmm.
knew what they wanted to say but they got the form perfect
yeah
and I and she's so funny when she's just about to get raped on there and
oh yeah
it's
I know
like, it's like
so upsetting but also very very
she's,
funny
she's terrific
she's a co-star in my first feature film looking forward. Go watch it, people, for free. YouTube, it's out there.
Looking forward.
Yes.
Okay.
My fake presidential campaign took 8 years to finish.
And she's in it.
She's in it. She plays one of my campaign managers / one of my childhood friends. Even
really?
We haven't known each other.
Well, name
since
a few
childhood.
More people. I mean, they're all my favorite people in the world.
Matt Sachs is in that. Good God, those are the few that I can remember right off the top of my head.
Laura, do you know Scott Leggett?
I don't.
No. Okay.
I don't. We should mention where can people find your stuff though online.
Okay, well, At the moment I have two collections of comedy songs.
Mm-hmm.
They're both called Unchartables.
Okay.
There's Unchartables Volume 1, and that used to get played quite a bit on Sirius Radio.
Uh huh.
And then there's Richard Levinson's Unchartables Volume 2.
Okay.
In which I use a lot of other singers doing the songs. I'm not singing the songs so much. I have other people come in and do them. They do a much better job than I do. Because of the way CD Baby works, I wasn't allowed to feature. You can't say featuring for some reason.
Oh, weird.
It's all this weird political. It's like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. Anyway, yeah, so there's Unchartables Volume 1,
mm-hmm.
And which is just me doing the songs to a live audience. And then the Richard Levinson's Unchartables Volume 2. They're both available anywhere you can download anything anywhere. I mean,
all
you can
right.
go to CD Baby, you can go to iTunes, you can go to Amazon, you can go to any of those places. And I hope to have other stuff out sometime in the near future.
Awesome.
If they want to see some visual stuff just for free and for fun,
mm-hmm.
if you go to YouTube and put in the words sacred fools, serial killers, Richard Levinson, you will probably find a bunch of videos that, because they're shot kind of flat and stuff, they don't look that great. But there's a bunch of funny songs that were done for serial killers pieces at Sacred Fools.
Oh, awesome.
Probably 20 or 25 songs up there.
Cool.
Including six or seven at least from last year's Chick Tracks.
Oh, great.
And I really like a lot of those.
That sounds fun.
They're done so fast that there's no production. I mean, they're not well produced. It's not like you're going to see a TV show.
Sure.
You're seeing a bunch of people trying to remember their lines on stage that they rehearsed twice that were written that week. But they're top-notch people, and they we did a whole one about the Catholics called the Death Cookie. That again, this guy from the Chick Tracks does not like Catholics very much. So we got to goof on a guy who himself is goofing on the Catholics.
That's hilarious.
And we had him do a whole. We did a whole production number of the Eucharist and a bunch of people. It came out really well. I'm very happy with it.
That's awesome.
So, but it'll never get done anywhere else. It was just done for that particular show.
Yeah.
So yes, go download those songs.
Yes.
No one downloads anything anymore. No. I mean, you can actually go, at least for the first one, you can go to Spotify and listen to the crap for free.
Yeah.
Which I hate.
Yeah. Understandable.
I used to get checks. Oh man, I used to get checks every quarter for $12, $15. Now I don't get checks any quarter for $12 or $15 because they listen online. They'll send me a statement saying, yes, people listened. They listened to your song on Spotify or Rhapsody. And now we owe you 0.00023 cents.
Jesus Christ. People, support your artists.
Support your artists. I gotta buy gas on the way home from this, and how am I gonna do that if you don't buy it?
Pay real money to the people who are still around. Pay 50 cents for this album, because I'll bet you can. Not that it's not worth more, but I got it for a dollar, I think. So buy the album. Thank you for doing the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And
nothing makes
me
happy than to talk too much about the National Lampoon.
And please come back, because it'll be a lot of fun. Thank you guys for listening. Go to stolendress.com, which is where all my shit is. Thank you guys for listening, and as always, have a good thing.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.